who is off the schedule for today, and we will take the schedule in order except for what we're about to do right now. Due to a shortage of bodies here, we're going to go to a public hearing on Senate Bill 326. So, opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 326, and we'll get to our sign-up sheet here in just a moment.
So you're not going to be...
Excusing us, don't you, Mr. Chair?
Uh-huh, yeah, just keeping off balance.
Well, if we're paying attention, it's 35
over. What are we doing for 5 points at the beginning?
Why uniform building codes aren't uniform?
Yeah.
All right, we'll have our committee administrator here in just a moment. Tell us about Senate Bill 326. You're declining the opportunity to do that?
I can't find my file.
I can't believe you'd want to do that.
I'll tell you.
All right, Mr. Delaney, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Delaney. I'm manager of government relations at the Public Employees Retirement System. Senate Bill 326 seeks to amend ORS 243.505, dealing with the Deferred Compensation Advisory Committee. In 1991, the legislature allowed the PERS board to expand the deferred compensation program to include local governments. At that time, the Deferred Compensation Advisory Committee was made up of 5 members. With that expansion to include local government employers, the PERS board has sought this piece of legislation, which would expand the size of the Deferred Compensation Advisory Committee to 7 members. Those two additional members could then represent local governments or participants through local governments in the deferred compensation plan. So that is the sole purpose of this bill, is to expand the committee from 5 to 7 members to allow that increased representation by local governments.
Thank you. Anyone have any questions? No questions. Representative Harper, did you have something you wanted to say?
No.
All right. All right. Is there, thank you then. Anyone else to testify? All right. We'll close our public hearing on Senate Bill 326. We'll come back to that just a bit. I want to get back on schedule here.
You don't want to go to work session on this?
No, we won't do that right now. All right, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 785. And Bill Cross?
He's not here.
All right, let's close the work session on Senate Bill 785. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2140. Steve McCoy and Barb Hutchinson, please. Oh, and Representative Butler, please.
Nothing's dead in this building, so the gavels have dropped and such.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Committee of General Government. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to testify on behalf of certain amendments being proposed to House Bill 2140. We're hearing on the General Government Ways and Means Subcommittee the issues dealing with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, with the emphasis on control. And we're seeking for opportunities of ways that we can become much more effective and efficient administrators within the purviews of the law. When we got involved in some of the discussions of what was happening and some of the concerns of retailers and all of the myriad of questions that came up, we realized that perhaps we were doing not as good a job as we could, and perhaps training. And so in an attempt to be proactive relative to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, we asked that we should increase the fines. Now, I put a higher limit than what we ended up with, but there was a consensus that the fines, which are currently set at $2,000, which were established in 1969, would go to a maximum of $5,000. And then in that process, that the fines be used only as a deterrent, that they not be immediately imposed at the highest amounts, but that they be used, that training opportunities be used early on, and an opportunity to, or given an opportunity for retailers to go ahead and have an opportunity to train their employees as to how to identify those that were under age 26 or whatever higher age that they would prefer to have their employees trained to examine documentation and how to examine documentation so that we would have fewer violations, and that further education could and would be required if at any time there were violations or further sanctions such as additional education would be imposed if there were additional violations. Finally, to put some teeth into it, we also gave the Liquor Control Commission an opportunity in this legislation, in the amendments, to go ahead and allow but not require the commission to approve the use of age verification equipment in lieu of these fines. In other words, at first you give them an incentive to educate, and then you have incentives to follow up on education and more mandatory training, and then you allow them to continue with opportunities to put in age verification equipment, in effect stripers, which allow the retailers an opportunity to stripe licenses and those kinds of things prior to actually imposing additional cash sanctions. And all of this was an attempt to work towards the trying to get those underage folks from attempting to buy alcoholic beverages at retail outlets. And through the good offices, and I do appreciate the good work that Robert Hutchinson has done for us, and appreciate Steve McCoy and others who have worked on behalf of the retailers to work out some compromise language to try and help and assist us to come to a responsible vendor program. And ladies and gentlemen of the committee, if we could get just a cut in half of those under the age of 21 who are illegally buying alcoholic beverages from legal retail vendors in this state, I think this program is well worth it.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Butler? Representative Harper.
Can you give me just a short what age verification equipment is, how much it costs, what's the process?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Harper. It's my understanding that there's a couple of different varieties of the age verification, and for the lack of a better word, I'll call them stripers, that are presently available on the market. If we go to a uniform system statewide, we feel like that statewide it could cost less than $1,000 per unit. Now, we're still talking less than the $5,000 fine, and these are added in lieu of the loss of licenses and fines, and Ms. Hutchinson can tell us of other issues that work up the sanctions, trying to get to the point before there's any loss of license. But a striper could be, without a uniform striping system statewide, a striper could cost as much as $2,000, and it may not read a current Washington license. It may not read an old Oregon license, and again, it would be sensitive to striping information that's put on your license when you obtain your license, and date information is barcoded onto the license itself. Barring the language or barring the barcoding itself, if the barcoding is not there on the striper, and a beeper would go off, and a person would have to then physically take the document in front of them, the identification document in front of them, and enter the birth date, which shows on the equipment or on the document itself, into the equipment. Now, if that's date sensitive, and if that birth date indicates that person is under the age of 21 years of age, an alarm will go off. The documentation would be retrieved, and it's all over. Person hits the door as fast as they can.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Representative Butler. I have a question about how this would actually work in reality. If, in fact, I own a liquor store, a liquor package store, and I have different shifts working in that store,
if somebody gets cited, say on the day shift, and then somebody else gets cited on the evening shift, am I to assume that there would be no penalty because you've got different employees working different hours being sanctioned for selling alcohol, that there would be no penalty at all?
For the record, Steve McCoy representing the Oregon Grocery Industry Association, Chair Wilson, Representative Bowman. No, there would be penalties in this case. The way this bill reads, we have a responsible retailer or vendor program built in. By rule, there's going to be a set of criteria that any employer is going to have to adhere to as far as training their employees on the proper sales techniques and, you know, checking for ID, how you identify it, all those kinds of issues, dealing with visibly intoxicated persons, all those issues. Once they enter the program and can show that they have followed the responsible vendor criteria, if there is a sale, in this case, we're dealing more with minors under the using what we call the sting program or a decoy program, where in conjunction with the OLCC or the local law enforcement agency, they're sending minors in an attempt to purchase to see if in fact we're adhering to the law. If a sale was made and the employer could show that, yes, they were a responsible vendor, that they'd adhered to everything, they would still be subject to a civil penalty, to a fine, but they would not be subject to the cancellation of their license because of accumulation of sales by their employees, as long as they've done everything that they are called on to do as a responsible vendor by the OLCC. So that's one of the reasons the fine ceiling has been lifted from $2,000 to $5,000, so there can be a more, I guess, progressively more punitive sanction civilly on them up to as high as $5,000 if they continue to sell. And if you look at the language, it says that the commission may not cancel or deny the issuance of a license if they're opening another retail unit, but it doesn't say anything about suspension. So suspension, if even though they're in the responsible vendor program, if their employees, for whatever reason, something's not working and the employees are still selling, suspension of the license for some set is still an option.
If I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure, go ahead.
And what happens to the employers who choose not to participate in the voluntary program that you just mentioned?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, I guess there is a current sanction schedule in existence right now, which basically says if you sell to a minor four times in a two-year period, and it's a sort of a revolving two-year period, you can be subject to cancellation of your license. So if they choose not to do the training, they choose to go it on their own, and they frankly be an irresponsible employer, well, then they're going to basically probably end up losing their license.
Thank you. Mr. McCoy, we'll go ahead and turn our attention to you here for just a moment. I want to talk about the responsible vendor program. We've obviously seen the reasons to become involved in this thing. Could you give us a quick read on why this is good for the folks that you represent?
Yes, Chair Wilson. We have been in, a dialogue for the last probably 18 months with the OLCC, with the commission, with the staff, and I'd like to take this moment to thank Pam Erickson and Barb and the staff, as well as Representative Butler, for their cooperation in this issue. But it's been a long journey here for 18 months. The issue became with us, again, was the fact that since I think March of 97, there's been a marked increase in the number of minor decoy operations, or stings, as we call them, using the minors to go and attempt to purchase to see if everything's going on well, not only with the OLCC, but with local law enforcement agencies. That sort of ran into a conflict with the existing sanction schedule that I just referred to, where in a two-year period, if you had four sales, you were subject to cancellation. In this day and age, whether you're a supermarket or a convenience store or mom and pop, especially with the smaller retailers, the sales of beer and wine can be as much as 25% of your sales volume. So you lose your ability to sell beer and wine, even though you're a responsible retailer, you're pretty much going to be out of business competitively. So we have been working with them in some way. The issue became real quickly. We had retail members who had excellent training programs, and they were doing everything they were supposed to do as a responsible employer, putting their people through the training program, making sure, putting up signage, had a 1-800 number in some cases to call if you saw anybody
one of their courts, breaking the law, everything you could think of to do. In most cases, if the clerk sold, even on a sting, they lost their job, did everything they could think of to do, and for some reason you could not get down to total compliance. There was a certain segment of the employee base, even despite the training, were continuing to sell. Well, we became concerned at that point that we had responsible employers who, through the actions of employees that they trained and trained well and done everything they could think of to do, and in many cases we were going to the commission saying, here's what we're doing, what else can we do? And we're getting to the point where they couldn't think of anything else that they could add to the list of things to do. We didn't think at that point that it was quite right that they'd be subject to the loss of the cancellation of their license and potentially, depending on the size of the store and the location, the loss of their business. So we've tried to work with the commission to get to some point where we have a compromised situation, and this responsible vendor program really is it. We're sort of trying to get ahead of the curve and say, join this program, adhere to these philosophies, do the training that's involved, and if you're doing all those things on an ongoing basis, and you can record that if and when you get a violation, hopefully this will reduce the number that are selling also. But if that violation occurs and you've been a responsible employer, you're going to get fined, and the fines are going to be more punitive than they have been, but you're not going to be subject to the cancellation of your license. And that's really where we're at.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. McCoy? Representative Starr.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a question. You might have covered this when I was out of the room. On page 4, line 10, there's a blank for civil penalty. Is that going to be filled in Ways and Means? Is that, or do you have a number to fill in?
Chair Wilson, Representative Starr, that would be $500.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Barb, would you like to say a few words about this bill?
Just for the record, Barb Petrick from the Liquor Commission. I don't really have very much more to add. This definitely has been a cooperative venture between the industry, the commission, and Chair Butler has played a very important role in all of this. I guess sometimes we have to come down and under pressure of the legislative session of get together and figure out how to work some of these things out that sometimes seem difficult or impossible to work out otherwise. The bill, as it's written now with these amendments, gives the commission greater latitude, greater flexibility with regard to fines. It gives us an opportunity to get at the clerks who are actually the ones who are selling, and requires some mandatory training for them. They should be fairly motivated if they've already been caught. It gives an opportunity for licensees to call us when they're hiring somebody to find out whether or not the person they're thinking about hiring has, in fact, violated. We'll have a database on those folks. And the Responsible Vendor Program, I'm really glad we came up with the idea because, as Steve said, there have been a number of people that have come before the commission who have done everything that they can possibly do. Now, none of us have any sympathy for a licensee who sells. I mean, shame on them. They're in the business. But some of the licensees who are really doing everything they can with their employees, including doing their own inside stings and giving their folks rewards of up to $100 when they pass a sting, deserve some breaks. And I think this piece of legislation goes a long way in that area.
Thank you. Any questions? All right. We appreciate it very much. All right, we're in the work session on this bill, and we will need a conceptual amendment if we are to fill in that blank with the figure $500. And so I would take a motion on the conceptual amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Starr.
Do we have to suspend the rules to do that?
Yes.
I move to suspend the rules for purpose of adopting conceptual amendments.
Representative Starr moves to suspend the rules for the purpose of adopting conceptual amendments. Are there any objections? All right, seeing no objections, rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Starr.
I move that we insert $500 on line 10 of page 4 of the dash 3 amendments.
Representative Starr makes a motion that we add $500 to the blank, line 10, page 4 of the amendment. Any discussion? Any objection? Okay. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I'd move the dash 3 amendments as conceptually amended to House Bill 2140.
Representative Starr moves the dash 3 amendments as conceptually amended into House Bill 2140. Is there any discussion?
clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Ashbeck? Bowman?
Yes.
Decker?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sinceri?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Thompson?
Aye. And the dash threes are amended into 2140?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I'd move House Bill 2140 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Starr moves House Bill 2140 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
Just for clarification purposes, it's been a long time since I've seen House Bill 2140. Didn't think I'd see it again, but here it is. I would like to know what amendments are included in the in House Bill 2140 as amended. We just adopted the dash three,
mm-hmm.
and that's it. That's the bill?
That is the bill.
Thank you.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
What a fine bill it is.
Any further discussion? All right, clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Yes.
Decker?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sinceri?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. And motion carries. And we'll have Representative Butler carry that. Thank you. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2140. Well, I'm going to go back to... Okay, I'm going to reopen a work session on Senate Bill 326, or actually open a work session on that. We had a public hearing on 326 right at the beginning. Some of you may have missed that. I want you to take a look at that just for a moment, and that we're in work session. And when you've had an opportunity to take a look at that, we will accept a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I move Senate Bill 326 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Bowman moves Senate Bill 326 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have any discussion? All right. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Yes.
Decker?
Aye.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sinceri?
I got it.
You didn't tell me to vote.
Okay. Sinceri?
Aye.
Yes.
William,
aye. And the motion carries. And volunteer for carrier, Representative Bowman. Thank you. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 326. And we'll now open a work session on Senate Bill 785. Bill Cross, would you come forward, please? Just to remind the committee, Mr. Cross was before us last time, and a few others as well. And I want you to just again brief us for just a moment on 785 and what it will do for us.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Building Officials Association. The bill would allow by rule the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to allow for a field examination, a practical examination of a potential candidate for certification in either structural, mechanical, one and two family, or plans review to become a certified inspector in the state of Oregon. They would still have to take the state certification exam, but it would be a way for somebody who maybe doesn't meet all of the work experience requirements in terms of years or the quantity of time to fulfill, to become qualified to take the exam by virtue of passing some practical examination.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cross? All right. Thank you very much. And we'll entertain a motion on that bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkinson.
Move Senate Bill 785 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves Senate Bill 785 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have discussion here? All right, thank you. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Yes.
Decker?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri.
Aye.
Thompson.
Yes.
Wilson.
Aye. And the motion carries, and anybody like to be carried, Representative Atkinson will carry. Close the work session on Senate Bill 75. I'm trying to think people want to get out of here.
Just keep it up.
5:12 will be the end of that page.
We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 512. Kara, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, there is written testimony at your spot from Joe Brewer, who didn't get to testify last time, and this measure has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which is on the yellow piece of paper in front of you.
All right, thank you. I'd like to call forward Ray Phelps.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Good to have you here. I want to commend you for the work that you and a number of others have done on this.
Very much.
Quite frankly, a number of people have had a lot of concerns due to the fact of jurisdictions that they live in and represent, and so it's been a great concern that the parties involved here draw closer. Judging by what I read from materials supplied, that has happened. Would you go into detail on how that has happened, how it's taken form?
Yes, sir. Mr. Mike Greenfield and Joe Brewer coordinated several meetings between the stakeholders of the Metropolitan Building Codes Consolidation Task Force and the people who have, to this point, been opponents to the bill. The opponents, as I've indicated, I provided you with a memo addressed to the chair. The opponents have been the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, City of Portland, and the Oregon Building Officials Association. We have a long list of supporters, and you have that information before you. Areas of change that we found to be mutually beneficial and approved by the different folks was to change the composition of the board, not its number. Its number is very significant with regard to the quality of the work that's anticipated by this board. But rather than have two representatives of city building officials with different populations, what was agreed to was we would have an elected official of a city and we would have an elected official of a county, maintaining a representative of the city of building city building officials without concern with the size of population, and that we would reduce from two members of the public to one member of the public. That was accepted by all parties. The next change that we made, that we all agreed to, and I've given you conceptual amendments that affect in the memo that I've addressed to the chair. I did point out several times that there is the opportunity for expert participation because there's an unlimited opportunity for technical committees, and that's already in the bill. Rulemaking by the Tri-County Board was of concern with regard to its expanse or its broad capability. So we've made amendments to the bill to pull in that rulemaking authority to make it what it was really always intended to be. And that is, there would be real rulemaking authority for the board to accomplish all of the programs that were called for in Section 4 of the bill. You'll see that on page 3 of the bill. One is, and where we get into that is, in page 3, we deleted lines 39 and 40. On page 4, we deleted lines 7, 8, 9, and 10. And then on line 33, we deal with the issue in Section 8 where the original language called for the board to direct a municipality to take actions and that the rules would supersede any conflicting provisions. That has all been removed. The response now to the audits when reviewed by the board would be that the board would recommend to the department that it take such action as the board deems, or that the board determines necessary to ensure the effective and efficient administration of the state building codes. That was agreed to by all parties. And then there were several clarifying amendments. On page 3, we wanted to make it very clear at line 10 by inserting new language that the fees anticipated for the startup costs would be collected by the municipalities and remitted to the director, but it would not, but that would be the source of that that revenue. And in line 37, we wanted training also, and this was a recommendation of one of the city persons. We wanted training opportunities not only for persons who review building plans, but also for inspectors. That is what we need in order to really assure that we get the uniformity that we're looking for. And then on page 6, on lines 13, we make it perfectly clear that the appropriation that's needed for that training is not to exceed half of the money that is appropriated, not received but appropriated, so that there's more money received than there is appropriated as a limitation on the department. But the theory is that a great deal of the construction activity in the state, more than half of it, occurs there, and so obviously half of the work is there, and reasonably half of the people are there, so we would train in that regard. That's basically the presentation. I mean, that's basically what we agreed to. There still is, as I've noted in the memo to you, a difference of opinion with respect to some aspect of the training. The folks who have that concern are the League of Oregon Cities and the building officials. The City of Portland and Clackamas County don't share that concern. Also, for your information, given these changes, notwithstanding the training issue that I think we can resolve, but I think it's going to take time past this meeting, but I think we can resolve it. I believe that the City of Portland and Washington Clackamas County will support this bill.
Thank you.
That's the indications I've been getting. Right. Or at least go neutral, but I believe they will support.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Phelps?
Mr. Chair, if I might, I just want to congratulate Mr. Phelps. You had told me last week at this time that we'd actually sit here with a bill that there's some agreement on. I would have told you out of your mind. So I compliment you as well.
Thank you.
Job well done.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, she just defined a lobbyist.
A good one.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate
yes,
that.
Pardon me?
No, not yet. Jane Cummins, would you come up this way? Appreciate it. Welcome back. I wanted to, with both of you here, I want to talk to you about the training issue. How big of an issue is that? You know, obviously, this whole thing, as noted, has come a long way, and we're butting into that point, and want to know exactly how big of an issue this is with you right now.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Jane Cummins with the League of Oregon Cities, and this is Bill Cross, the Executive Director of the Oregon Building Officials Association. I'll make some brief comments and then ask him to go into any details. The training dollars, the training issue is a significant one for cities and building officials. As you know, what we have been striving for in the state is not only to have a statewide code, but to have uniformity and consistency in its application. And training is a very key aspect of how we get there. And we have had the concern that we have, here we have half of the training dollars being taken from BCD and going to a board in a region of the state. And since this has been called a model or a pilot, we see that there are going to be other regions of the state that are also going to want, you know, their dollars of training going into BCD coming back to them. And we have felt very strongly that we need to keep statewide training. And what we have in the discussions in 512, we have tried to approach it in a way where the region itself can identify and develop the programs that they think that they need. And that relates to, I think it's Section 4, Sub 9, where there was a change that Mr. Phelps mentioned in adding training for not only plans reviewers, but also those who are doing the inspections. But we wish that the dollars would stay at DCBS, that they would receive them, that they would remain there with DCBS, and that the board or any other region, for that matter, that had specific or unique training needs, you know, could identify them, send them to DCBS, and then DCBS would assure that those training needs are met, with the caveat that the dollars that go to the region would not exceed half of those that are allocated. And we think that that is a safeguard not only for the Tri-County area, but is a safeguard in looking down the road for any other proposals that we get.
Thank you. Mr. Cross?
Mr. Chair, my name is Bill Cross with the Oregon Restaurant.
Oh?
Oh, my God.
7 after 2,
new career.
That takes me back 12 years. Excuse me.
Not doing
with the Oregon anymore. Building Officials Association. We have the Oregon Building Officials want to make this bill work, and we have come a long ways to try and resolve with the proponents the issues, and I think Ray Phelps has done a good job trying to facilitate and trying, along with Mr. Greenfield, to try and get some conclusion and compromise. And we feel not enthusiastic but comfortable that with the changes in the makeup and the rulemaking authority and the scope that we can make this work. Our concern does remain, and we're very close, but does remain over the dedication of the 1% dollars, or the transfer of those 1% dollars to the board's separate fund versus staying with the director or the department and having the department go ahead and allocate up to the 50% of those monies are actually appropriated for education and training in the state to go back to unique needs. We feel that if the director then remains responsible for doing the program or the contracts, a lot of it they subcontract out, but they can ensure that there's some uniformity and consistency with training that will go on in other regions. And we need to use as best we can consistent, particularly code change training and programs that may be developed by organizations or the department itself. So it's really one of trying to ensure that the board has the opportunity to develop and recommend to the director how they would identify the unique needs and what kind of programs they would like to see, but I guess have the director disperse those monies rather than it going to the board, because we're going to have more of these boards. And
all right. Thank you. Appreciate that. Any questions? All right. I want to commend all parties again for doing what you've done to get us to this point. I would like, if possible, to see this wind up being something that everybody is maybe just a little bit happier about Thursday than you are now. I'd like to talk to all parties involved in this Thursday morning, if I might. I'm going to go ahead and schedule this for another work session on Thursday. Thursday is the last day of our committee. We'll be shutting down after that. And so like to talk to you all on Thursday morning, and we'll see how we're doing by Thursday afternoon. All right.
Appreciate
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 512.
Yeah, good work, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 1201. Kara, please.
Mr. Chair, members, there are two amendments One of them should be in your file, the dash A2, which changes one word from property to proposed. That was just a scrivener's error, I believe. There's a dash A4 at amendment at your place that Mr. Marshall from the School Board Association is going to discuss, I believe, on behalf of Representative Starr and his school district.
And it don't.
John Marshall, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. We are bringing you an amendment to resolve an issue in a single school district that finds itself in a very severe financial circumstance. Before I explain that circumstance, I want to make clear that this issue is not a function of the level of school funding. Obviously, all school districts benefit the higher the level of school funding, and that's an issue that we're all going to talk about and deal with. But this is an issue of a situation where a new superintendent and an audit discovered, for lack of a better term, a tangled web of financial difficulty. What we are doing is bringing an amendment to you and to this bill that will allow the school district to proceed with correction of this financial circumstance. The new superintendent, based on the results of the audit, moved forward with apprising the board of the situation. The board decided to involve the community. The board immediately hired outside counsel in the form of a retired school district superintendent that now does financial management work. They've developed a financial restructure plan. And in order to carry that plan forward in as open and honest a way possible, the amendment before you is necessary. And what it does, it applies, and by the way, this is Senate Bill 1201-A4, and I believe you have that in front of you. It applies only to the bank's school district and allows that school district for up to 4 years to carry forward a negative cash balance. That amendment is needed because that would not be allowed under local budget law. So what we're doing, in effect, is creating an exception to local budget law to allow that to occur for up to 4 years. When I said open and honest, obviously a way to resolve this issue would be for the school district to overestimate its revenues and produce a balanced budget. But because of the honesty with which the board wanted to proceed, involvement of the community in resolving the issue, they decided that it would be more appropriate and more honest to come to you with this proposed amendment. I would encourage your support. The superintendent from the Bank School District, Marilyn McGlasson, is here, and I have a copy of a letter that provides some detail about other action they've taken. And Mr. Chair, members, if you wish to pursue, I'd be glad happy to share that letter with you.
Thank you. Representative Starr, anything you want to add about this amendment?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to compliment Ms. McGlasson for the work that she did when she came into a situation. I think she's done an outstanding job of number one, discovering a problem and taking corrective action to get out from under the problem that they've found in a way that minimizes as much as possible hurt or damage to the students in the Bank School District. That's the folks that are at risk here. I think it's real important that we recognize this is a local community that just needs a little cover to pull itself out of a problem that was created. Not the students' fault, not the current superintendent's fault. I don't believe that the local school board is at fault as well, and I think that this is an appropriate action for us to give a local school district and a local community, a small rural community, the tools that it needs to pull itself up by the bootstraps. And I commend the work that Ms. McGlasson has done in the community and working together to recognize a problem and really work hard to get to a solution.
Thank you. All right, well, it's good enough. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. All right, we're in a work session currently, and let me ask the committee, do any of you have any unresolved concerns about the main body of the bill, Senate Bill 1201? Okay, no. Hearing none, we will be happy to entertain some motions here.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I would move the A2 amendment to Senate Bill 1201.
A4.
Representative Starr moves the A2 amendment into Senate Bill 1201. Is there any discussion?
Yes, I have to find the A2.
Which color is it?
Again, this
is it's white.
It's a typo.
Again, this fixes a typographical error that was in the bill.
There you go.
I'll give you a moment to take a look at the line and a half there.
Hmm.
Any discussion of that? Any objections? All right. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I'd move the dash A4 amendments to Senate Bill 1201.
Representative Starr moves the dash A4 amendments into Senate Bill 1201. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I apologize. If Representative Starr could tell me what this does in English, that would be helpful.
Sure, absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, what we currently have is in statute. It is illegal or not lawful for a local school board or a city or a county to operate with a negative ending fund balance.
Okay.
What this does is it accepts bank school district from that law so that they can continue for a period of not greater than 4 years to work themselves out of a problem that they found themselves in.
Thank you.
All that it does.
I came in on the end, so I appreciate that explanation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion of the dash A4s? All right. Any objection? All right. Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I'd move Senate Bill 1201 as amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Starr moves Senate Bill 1201 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Right. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson.
Aye.
Beck.
Aye.
Bowman.
Yes.
Deckard.
Aye.
Parker.
Aye.
Starr.
Aye.
Unseri.
Yes.
Thompson.
Yes.
Wilson.
Aye. And the motion carries. Representative Starr, would you do that for us, please?
Please.
Thank you. Work session is closed on Senate Bill 1201.
Motoring.
We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 361. And Steve Delaney from PERS, please. Just advise the committee not to get too far afield here. We're making good time and expect to keep doing that today.
My wife told me to make it. You join us by asking questions. We'll be out of here.
All right, Mr. Delaney, thank you. And would you talk to us about 361, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Steve Delaney, Manager of Government Relations at the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System. The PERS plan is a tax-qualified plan, meaning that the Internal Revenue Service defers collection of taxes on the funds that accrue in the plan, and that, of course, is very important to the retirement benefits being paid to our members. To continue that tax qualification, a number of federal law changes have occurred through the past few years, which are collectively called the TRA 86 amendments. And the PERS plan is required by December 31, 2000 to apply for a review of the plan by the Internal Revenue Service to ensure that our plan continues to meet Internal Revenue Code requirements for a tax-qualified plan. What you have before you then in Senate Bill 361 are the changes that Department of Justice has recommended in preparation for sending this material on to the Internal Revenue Service. And what Department of Justice did is they looked at PERS rules and statute, and the majority of the changes here are simply wording changes. If the Internal Revenue Code said that a government plan must be sure that an employer that's disqualified isn't part of the plan, we would literally put that in, word for word, into this statute so that the Internal Revenue Service auditor would find their language word for word in our statute and would not have any question in reviewing. So let me just briefly review for you what's found in this bill, and I'll point out to you the substantive changes that did occur with this. There are a few that would change the way we do things today, and I'll point those out as I run through this with you briefly. In Section 1, the memo that I've handed out to you, Section 1 simply clarifies that both rules and statute together form the PERS plan. In Sections 2, 3, and 4, it clarifies that if a public employer for any reason is found to be a reason for disqualifying the PERS plan, then the PERS board would take action to remove that public employer from the PERS plan. I will clarify, a number of employers have contacted us. There is no plans on PERS part to remove any employers. This, again, is language that's found in Internal Revenue Code, and we wanted to make sure that it was also in PERS statute. Sections 5, 6, and 7 amends when a member can get their money out of PERS. It states that you truly have to separate from your employer. This is one of the substantive changes. It's a minor change, but it is a substantive change from what we currently do. Currently in PERS, if you drop below 600 hours, which is the minimum for PERS, you can withdraw your account. This would change that, and we'd now say you actually have to separate from your employer completely. You couldn't just drop below the 600. You must separate completely before you could withdraw your PERS account. Section 8 is simply stating that PERS trust assets can only be used for the exclusive benefit of beneficiaries. Again, language found in Internal Revenue Code simply being added to our statute. Section 9 states that members have a vested interest to a benefit. Sections 10 and 11 are allowing the PERS board to make some changes with regard to the minimum distribution law found in Internal Revenue Code. This would be one of the substantive changes being made to our current statute. Presently, an individual after age 70 and a half, which is the age that the Internal Revenue Service uses for determining benefit payments as far as minimum distribution, a person can make a change to those benefits at a later date if they were to retire at a later date. This would state that there could not be a change after that age because the Internal Revenue Service does not allow for that kind of change. It's under the minimum distribution law. Sections 12 through 15 is one of our changes. This is another substantive change dealing with service credit purchases. Currently, when a person's retiring, they have a number of purchase options, and they can pretty much purchase whatever they want if they're qualified for it. This would impose the limits found in Internal Revenue Code 415. It state that there are some dollar limits involved when making a purchase. Sections 16 through 18 are dealing with the requirements for a person to be eligible for health benefits. It simply puts into PERS statute the requirement language found in Internal Revenue Code. No change there. Sections 19 and 20 provide that if PERS can't locate an individual that is due a benefit, that the benefit is suspended, the person loses a right to that benefit, and is put off in a holding account, with the proviso that once the person's found, they are due that benefit again. It's just the Internal Revenue Service is saying you can't have money being held out there due a person and you're not paying it. So if we can't find the person, we hold it in abeyance, as it were, and then would pay it to them at a later date once they're found.
And can I ask a question?
Representative Bowman.
Thank you. Does that mean that once the person has been found, they will get whatever interest they would have earned on that money up until the date that you found them? Or does it start accumulating again from the date that you find the individual?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, the interest would stop when we determine that we cannot locate the individual. And once they're located, then interest would again accrue until the point PERS actually makes payment of the benefit to the individual.
Does that have anything to do with the IRS? And
The abeyance portion.
And the abeyance portion meaning?
Meaning that you must stop the benefits, that you must withhold this benefit until that person is located. You cannot be holding money for an individual after age 70 and a half, the minimum distribution. You must pay this money out. That if you cannot locate that person, then you, in essence, take this benefit away. That meets the Internal Revenue Code purposes. You're no longer holding a benefit for this person. Then if they're later located, this statute would allow PERS to reinstate that benefit in line with Internal Revenue Code, and interest would then begin accruing once again until payment is made to the individual.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What circumstances would you not be able to find an individual?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, it would be a very rare situation. This is simply a requirement the Internal Revenue Service would be looking for in our language.
because I would think I'd find you.
Yeah. Representative is correct.
Would not be a problem.
No, it wouldn't be a problem.
Okay, go ahead, proceed.
And finally, sections 21 through 24, simply some conforming amendments to the language. So that, in gist, is what this very large bill does. Again, the bulk of it is simply language to satisfy the Internal Revenue Service auditors when looking at the PERS plan.
Thank you. Committee, questions? I noted something here that I wanted to address briefly that you might make me feel a little bit better about, and that's back to Section 5, Prohibition on In-Service Distributions. Again, the purpose for having to separate fully and not simply drop below 600 hours in order to, as I understood it, to withdraw your funds. Is that having anything to do with IRS confirmation, or is that something else independent of that?
Mr. Chair, that is specifically because of the Internal Revenue Service requirements, and that is why it is a change from PERS current situation. It's something we found that we had to do to bring ourselves into compliance with Internal Revenue Code.
Right. Thank you. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could ask one more.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So currently we allow retired people to come back and work up to a certain point, and whether it's teachers or whatever, until they come up smack against their benefit. And so if this passes, retired people will no longer be able to come back on a part-time basis and assist in either teaching or whatever else?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bowman, no, this does not impact. That's the issue of reemployed retirees, retirees returning to work under their 1,039 hours so that they do not reinstitute membership.
Right.
This issue on minimum distribution is regarding a person that is still an active member and now preparing to take out their benefit. This would not in any way impact the individual that's simply returning to work under that 1039 limit.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Delaney, thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. I'd like to call up Jim Green, OSBA, and Mr. Green is going to talk about proposed dash B9 amendments. Green, are these in fact B9 amendments?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are. For your record, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. An issue has come up to many public employers in light of the Tanner decision. The Tanner decision basically says to public employers, you must provide benefits along the lines of health and life insurance to your employees who have domestic partners, just as if they were employees who did not have domestic partners. The Internal Revenue Code, if we as public employers and school districts provide that benefit to an employee who has a domestic partner, the Internal Revenue Code calls that level of the level of benefit, the value that is given to that employee for the domestic partner, income for which they are taxed. PERS is taking the position that since the Internal Revenue Service calls that income, then it is salary subject to PERS benefits for public employers. That amount, that level of salary under PERS would vary from district to district and school districts depending on that level of benefit the person would seek. We don't know how much of an impact it is, but we do know that if, let's say, you provide a $400 level benefit up and above salary, that it could be attributed as much as $200. On that, employers have to make their contributions, which can be upwards of 11% after we go to the new employer contribution rates. If they have bargained to pick up the 6%, that goes up to 17%. So in effect, you're providing a higher PERS benefit to an employee who has a domestic partner versus an employee who doesn't have a domestic partner or is traditionally married. And it is a cost that has not been anticipated by public employers across the state. I have presented this amendment to everybody that I felt would be affected by it. I have not heard anything negative. The only concern I do understand is from PERS. They don't have a problem with the amendment. They have concerns that it be stuck into this bill because of the priority necessary for this bill, and we see it as a priority necessary for this amendment as well. I don't believe there is any opposition to this amendment as to the issue it gets to. And the amendment, if you'll take a look at it real quickly, it is lengthy because it has to go into all the definitions of salary, but the amendment is truly just on page 5, lines 2 and 3. And it refers back to page 4 that salary does not include, and you'll look at lines 2 and 3, payments made by an employer for insurance coverage provided to a domestic partner of an employee. And what this amendment gets to is leveling the playing field so that we don't have disparate treatment among our employees and additional costs that we did not anticipate prior to the Tanner decision. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Green? All right. None. Thank you. Appreciate that. All right. That concludes our public hearing on Senate Bill 361, and we'll go into a work session on Senate Bill 361 and accept motions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I move the B9 amendments into Senate Bill 361.
Thank you. Representative Bowman moves the B9 amendments into Senate Bill 361. Is there any discussion? Any objection? All right. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I move Senate Bill 361 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves Senate Bill 361 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? All right, clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Bowman? Yes.
Deckert?
Yes.
Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Perry?
Aye.
Thompson?
Yes.
Wilson?
Aye. And the motion carries. Volunteer for a carrier here.
Chris had mentioned that when he before it came out, he came over to me and said, I'd like to carry this bill.
I'm thinking that I heard that too. So. Representative Beck will carry that for me. All right, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 361. Thank you for the suggestion, Representative Deckard.
Oh. Hold on, you too. That's it.
Yes. All right, we will now open a work session on Senate Bill 323. Let's make that a public hearing. Public hearing on Senate Bill 323.
You know what it's for? Did you vote for that bill or not?
Can
you
get him
the first person?
Thanks, committee. Moving right along.
Appreciate it.
All right, Mr. Delaney is back to talk to us about Senate Bill 323. Welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again for the record, my name is Steve Delaney, manager of government relations at the Public Employees Retirement System. Senate Bill 323 is a housekeeping bill for PERS with five basic changes being made at the request of the PERS board. Sections 1 and 2 is a sunset clause with regard to the accrual of interest on the House Bill 3349 benefit adjustment payments. Statute requires PERS to pay 9% interest on these benefits until they're paid. PERS has paid all retirees that are due this benefit adjustment, but those people that took a refund are also due this adjustment, and there are about 6,000 individuals who took refunds that have not yet been located. This accrual of interest, therefore, is what we're wishing to suspend, not the right to these individuals to draw this benefit. So what this would do is sunset the interest. Once this bill becomes effective, the persons would be able to draw their benefit with interest that accrued up to that point once they are located. Just to assure the committee that PERS is making every effort to find these individuals, we're working with the employers, and we're now working with the Internal Revenue Service, submitting our list of Social Security numbers of the individuals, and the Internal Revenue Service will be forwarding letters on to these folks to let them know that they have a benefit payment available to them through PERS. Sections 3 and 4 of this bill clarifies the definition of final average salary for PERS. It specifies that it can be a partial year as well as a full year. Last year, out of 6,600 retirees, three people would have gotten a better benefit if we had used partial year as one of the three high years rather than full year. The Department of Justice has notified PERS that really the statute could be read either way, and it was just best to get clarification through housekeeping that indeed both a partial and a full year could be used in this calculation. I would mention that of those three individuals that would get a better benefit through using a partial rather than a full year, the amounts we're talking about as far as benefit differences was $72, $37, and $8. Section 5 deals with the spousal consent. It's closing an unusual loophole that PERS got caught up in with regard to the spousal consent requirement. This states that when a person's retiring and is required to get a spousal consent form signed, that if within the 60-day period that a person can make a benefit change after they choose when to retire, if their spouse were to decease, they're not required to submit another spousal consent form to change their benefit. It's actually something we encountered, and so this is housekeeping to clarify that. Section 6.
That really makes sense.
It does.
I think they need to get the consent.
Section 6 simply clarifies there are a few places in PERS statute that speak of PERS sending a check to beneficiary. This would allow PERS to actually make payment via electronic fund transfer. Finally, Section 7 allows the PERS board to contract with out-of-state health insurance providers with regard to the Medicare subsidy program. Currently, PERS can provide HMO coverage to individuals living, for instance, in Southern California based on the contract we have with the Kaiser Permanente folks here in Oregon. But federal law is changing that. As of December 31, 2000, PERS will not be able to use a contract signed here in Oregon to apply to folks living elsewhere. And so this would allow PERS, therefore, to contract with HMO program in New York City or in Washington or so on, if that's what's needed to continue the coverage of individuals that are currently participating in this plan. Now, that's, of course, the HMO coverage. Anyone's eligible for the ODS health insurance. It just tends to be a little more expensive. Those are the five housekeeping changes proposed in this bill. I'm available for questions.
Thank you. Could I can I go back to Section 2 for just a moment? I'm sorry, I must have spaced out there for a moment. Again, that that issue revolves around individuals who can't be found?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Any questions from the committee? Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Delaney, I just was curious. I noticed in the Senate vote you had 27 ayes and 3 nays. Any stated reason why we had 3 no votes in the Senate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, I'm not sure what the particular reason for those 3 nays were. I will tell you that there has been some question and discussion with Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, with regard to PERS being able to contract with out-of-state health insurance providers. While it's not a new benefit, it's already a benefit available to the individual, the county cities are concerned that if PERS can find cheaper insurance elsewhere, then those retirees that couldn't afford insurance at this time may be able to afford insurance at a later date because PERS is able to find some cheaper alternative. And for every individual that does decide to take advantage of the insurance because it's cheaper, it costs employers $60 as part of the Medicare subsidy. Now, again, it's not a new benefit. That's available to all folks, but to the extent that PERS finds a cheaper alternative, more people may take advantage of that current benefit than might otherwise.
So if I can follow up, so that in that circumstance, limited as it may be, there would be a fiscal impact to cities and counties?
There could be a fiscal impact.
I wanted to talk to you briefly about the partial year versus full year benefit. You've mentioned in this particular case it only has led to windfall for 3 people, as it were. What is the long-term implication of that? Any projection on that? I know we don't have a fiscal or anything like that, but
Mr. Chair, we don't have a fiscal, so I can only really speak anecdotally at this point. It, of course, only applies for an individual that retires under the full formula, and as we've seen in many of the articles and papers and so on, the bulk of PERS retirees currently are going out under money match. When it's a money match calculation, the number, whether you use a full or partial year, has no impact.
Mm-hmm.
So it would only be to the extent that in the future that you get this swing from money match back to full formula, that would be only with the Tier 2 mm-hmm. individuals. I can indicate that originally the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, was concerned that this might be a possible cost, but as we worked together on the Senate side with this, they did withdraw their objections to this particular piece as they did not foresee it being a major impact on the bill.
All right. Thank you. Any further questions? All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate that. I haven't polled the committee. Does anybody have any specific heartburn on this one? Okay. We will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 323, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 323.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I move Senate Bill 323
to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Bowman moves Senate Bill 323 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson?
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Yes.
Deckard? Parker?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Yes.
Thompson? Wilson?
Aye. That motion carries.
Mr.
And
Chair, as Representative Deckard was leaving, I heard him say
I
heard that too,
Mr. Chair. I think this is really a perfect example of the old saying, what goes around comes around. Representative Deckard will carry that bill. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 323, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1192. We'll find out who wants to
move this one quickly. You can get Thompson to
take part. All right. Steve Vincent, Mike Rainey, Matthew Shields.
Mr. Chair, members, while they're settling in, there's a -1 amendment at your spot.
All right, thank you. Gentlemen, welcome. And Mr. Vincent, would you like to take the lead, please?
Sure. Steve Vincent with Avista Utilities. I represent the natural gas utility in the Medford area. We asked for Senate Bill 1192 to create an incentive for individuals who purchase natural gas or other alternative fuel vehicles. Let me just give you a real quick background. The Business Energy Tax Credit administered by the Department of Energy it's an incentive for businesses to purchase alternative fuel vehicles. In that tax credit, and again, this tax credit is carried over a 5-year period, so as a business, you don't get the full benefit in the first year. You take over 5 years. We as the gas utility buy that tax credit from them at its net present value. So therefore, they get the benefit immediately up front because we cut them a check, and then we take the tax credit over the 5 years. So it's a really unique incentive that helps us buy down the cost of an alternative fuel vehicle. There's another program, the Residential Energy Tax Credit, or Residential Tax Credit Program, which is similar. It is an incentive for individuals to buy alternative fuel vehicles. This bill creates the same type of utility pass-through mechanism, is what we call it. It allows us to buy, or actually it allows the taxpayer to sell us the tax credit. And that's all this bill does. It's pretty short and simple. I can tell you, you want me to go into the -1s really quick?
I don't think so yet.
Okay.
All right, Mr. Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Graney, Assistant Director of the Office of Energy. We also support the bill. We think this mechanism will help encourage greater use of alternative fuel vehicles for individuals as well. Really, that's all I'd like to say. I've got some background for the committee on use of alternative fuel vehicles in the state. There's been quite a bit of interest. I think this will be a helpful tool.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matthew Shields. I'm actually sitting in here for Senator Shields, who's the sponsor of the bill. He's down the hall, but I thought I would try to field any questions if you had anything for him, or if you desperately need to talk to him, I can run down to Ways and Means and get him. But
thank you. Do we have any questions? Does anybody want Mr. Benson to go through the -1s?
Yeah.
All right. Very good. Gentlemen, thank you. Appreciate that.
Mr. Chair.
We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1192, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 1192.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkinson.
I'd like to move the -1s into Senate Bill 1192.
Representative Atkinson's moving the -1s into Senate Bill 1192. Do we have any discussion on the -1s? Any objections? All right, that motion is carried.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkinson.
I'd like to move House Bill Senate Bill 1192 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Atkinson moves Senate Bill 1192 to the floor as amended with a do-pass recommendation. Any further discussion? All right, clerk, please call the roll.
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Yes.
Deckard? Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sunseri?
Yes.
Thompson? Wilson?
Aye. And that motion carries. Representative Atkinson, will you do that?
Certainly.
Representative Atkinson will be the carrier. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1192. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1195.
Thank you.
On the home stretch. Same group, please. All right, Mr. Vincent, welcome back. And if you would explain to us what this bill does. This had three dissenting votes in the Senate, and if you'd comment on that as well. It's actually 25, 3, and 2 for the committee.
Steve Vincent of Vista Utilities again. This bill, originally introduced by Senator Shields, was to, its purpose was to include wind generation in the residential tax credit program. I came in the Senate with an amendment to include fuel cells, which is, if you want to see a picture, you can open up the brochure, and that's a copy that looks like a fuel cell. I could spend a lot of time, but I think you want to wrap this up. The three dissenting votes, this has a small revenue impact. I don't even think the Revenue Committee created a revenue impact on it because it was so small. We're trying to determine what that revenue impact could be. It's non-existent right now. Mr. Shields.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. If I recall correctly, the three dissenting votes were Senators Hannon, Trow, and Yee. I know that Senator Trow has made it a policy this session to vote against any measure which reduces revenue in even the slightest amount, and if I recall, the bill expects about a $5,000 revenue impact during the next biennium. Senator Hannon was concerned about what he referred to as a piecemeal approach to deciding on tax credits, and I don't recall Senator Yee speaking to her objection. So I.
All right, thank you. Mr. Graney, any comments on this? And would you, the energy guy, would you tell us a little bit about this program?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, again, Mike Graney from the Office of Energy. Our existing residential tax credit program provides individuals with a tax credit for using solar space and hot water heating and geothermal or ground loop heat pumps for hot water heating. It has been very popular over the years. Some 20,000 Oregonians over the life of the program have put in solar geothermal renewable resources. Some years ago, wind was eligible. I think it was in 1995 that it was eliminated. The program was simply narrowed to solar and geothermal. Prior to that, we only saw literally a handful of wind projects here. Wind for residential is pretty rare. You'd see 2 to 3 a year. But as a policy matter, we would like to see more wind. We think it makes sense. We also support encouragement of fuel cells. We think in the near term also the number of fuel cells is likely to be very small on a residential application, but the potential there and the promise is very encouraging. They're clean, they're compact, they would reduce energy use in the home substantially, and so we're supportive of both provisions of the bill.
Thank you. All right, any questions for these gentlemen? All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bowman.
I noticed that there's been significant additions added, like energy-efficient appliances and generators and equipment used to produce alternative fuels. I suspect that that will have a larger revenue impact if you take all those into account, since they're all new additions.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, actually what Legislative Council rewrote the definition, so those provisions in bold on page 1, starting with line 16, with the exception of wind and fuel cells, are currently eligible. What they did was that alternative energy device definition that previously existed from 7 through 15 they felt was grammatically unwieldy, and so Legislative Council rewrote that as part of amending the bill, and then the actual new law is the top of is just the fuel cells and wind. So alternative energy devices and appliances are already eligible.
Okay, I saw that after you pointed out. Thank you. Mr. Chair, if I could ask one more question.
Representative, go ahead.
Why was windmills taken out in the early 90s?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bowman, at the time, I think this was in 1995, the revenue committees were looking at, as you all are again, revenue difficulties. And they did a number of changes to a number of tax credit programs to simplify and sort of narrow the focus. And on the energy tax credits that had been broadly available for renewable resources, generally it was limited to solar, space, and hot water heating and geothermal grounded peat pumps. And in the case of the wind, it wasn't a revenue impact so much as simply narrowing the focus of the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, any further questions? Thank you. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1195, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1195.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
I move Senate Bill 1195 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Beck moves Senate Bill 1195 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? All right, seeing none, clerk, call the roll, please.
Atkinson.
Aye.
Beck?
Aye.
Bowman?
Yes.
Becker? Harper?
Aye.
Starr?
Aye.
Sinceri?
Yes.
Thompson? Wilson?
Aye. And
Chair.
That motion carries. Representative Beck.
Since I'm often accused of being one to be tilting at windmills, I'd be happy to be carrier on this bill.
Very, very appropriate. Your offer is certainly accepted. Thank you. Very, very.
Tilting at windmills.
All right. Yes. Hold on here just a moment. And also, before we go, I need to see Representative Starr, Sinceri, and Atkinson for just a moment. All right. Announcement for the committee. Thursday. Thursday committee may be held while floor session rages on. Please be flexible and come to the committee when you're allowed to. All right. No other business before us. We are adjourned. Good work. Thank you.
All right.